Right. So first of all, I was checking the medicines in Jhana Grove. I couldn't find any cough medicine in there. I think you're all taking some just in case. Bum, bump. But anyway, that's a nice funny story. And one of the nice things about meditation is that once you have some nice peaceful meditation, you're never scared of anything. One of the stories my preceptor told me, my preceptor was this, the abbot of Wat Saket in the middle of Thailand. He was also the acting Sangharaja for a while. And so he was a very good scholar monk, but I never really knew much about his upbringing. And he told me once that he was meditating, he was ordained, over in Koh Samui, the island which is now a big tourist island. In those days it was just a very little island off the coast towards the south of Bangkok. And he said that when he was ordained, like anybody else, as well as learning Pali and Dhamma, he also had to learn some meditation. And the story he told me, which was very nice and very thankful for him for telling it to me, was that he had to do some meditation. The only quiet place to do that meditation was in a coconut plantation. And so he was sitting under one of the coconut trees. It was quite safe, the coconuts wouldn't fall. But he got into what he said was a peaceful meditation. And when he came out of the meditation, he noticed there was a snake coiled in his lap. And he looked down at that snake, and you know, he had enough training from his teachers at school and from his parents and uncles and aunts. That was a very venomous snake. And it was so sort of venomous, he looked at it and he thought, why am I not afraid? He said one of the weirdest experiences, he would normally be afraid if a snake was that close, so just one bite it would kill him. But he looked down upon it and just had loving kindness and was totally at peace with it. So he closed his eyes, carried on meditating, and a few minutes later, just the snake just uncurled and crawled off and never harmed him at all. He said, it's one of the weirdest experiences. Something you'd normally be afraid of, because no good reason to be afraid. It was dangerous. But then he thought, no, he wasn't afraid. He didn't will it, it just happened. He was looking down there and a very venomous snake and it wasn't hurting him at all. Oh, he wasn't afraid at all. He said, that's one of the powers of meditation. Now your fear tends to disappear. But that has some problems to it. Because I remember just recently when I was in Sri Lanka, when I was waiting in the VIP lounge, and the people, and I actually asked them, shouldn't I be going to the gate now? And they said, it quite shocked me what they said. They said, don't worry, Ajahn Brahm, we'll get you there on time. You know that it's very rare does anyone say to me, don't worry. I felt embarrassed. It was true, they did get me to the gate on time. So I thought that was very funny. Anyway, one thing which I have to say at the beginning of this talk today, if you don't know already, you know, the day before the end of the retreat is always a special day for many reasons. Yes, it's somebody's birthday today. And the person whose birthday is today, I was just told, is Ajahn Santuti. It's Ajahn Santuti's birthday today. Is that correct? Yeah. But it also happens to be Venerable Soma's birthday as well. So Venerable Soma's having a birthday today. How old are you today? 41. Ajahn Santuti is 44. And that's in Thailand and also in Indonesia, in Chinese tradition, the number 4 stands for death. I'm sure you'll be fine. It's Ajahn Sutiti I'm worried about because he's 44 today. I hope he survives. But the best birthday I know is when, in Thai, it was when you're 55. Because the number 5 in Thai language is ha. So 55 is your ha-ha birthday. So anyhow, you know that I sometimes wondered, as a Buddhist monk, you know, when you leave the world, should you be celebrating these things, like birthdays or maybe a Waisak day? But even when it came to Christmas Day, in Wat Banana Chat, you know, that your upbringing, that was a day we celebrate something or other. When Ajahn Chah saw us saying to each other, Happy Christmas or something, now he actually asked us, what on earth are you doing? You're not Christians, you're Buddhists. And then we explained to him what it was. You know, the, how it's celebrated was the day of peace and harmony and goodwill to all beings. I still remember when I used to go and visit my family in London at that time, at Christmas time. I would do a lot of walking, either walking to other temples, trying to get around as much as possible. Because one thing which I objected to when I was young, I was looking for monks in London. There were monks in London, but you'd never see them. Really close to me, maybe just walking distance, there was this Sinhalese temple, the Sri Lankan temple in Chiswick. That was my area. I lived in London, went to school in Hammersmith, my father worked in Chiswick, and this was in Chiswick. And this was surprised. There actually was a Buddhist temple there, but I never saw any Buddhist monks. And the reason was, is when they went anywhere, they got picked up in the car from the gates of the Vihara, the temple, and they got taken to the appointments and then in the car again and back again. And I thought that that's not really appropriate for monks just to go in cars everywhere. It's great when they go on public transport. And so I kind of insisted when I was, especially a young monk, if I go and visit my family, I'll try and get the underground trains. You get these little cards. I forget what they're called. Is it Optus card or something? Anyway.
Oyster.
Huh? Oyster cards. And then you just have one of those and just go in the train and just get to your destination. It's much faster than going in cars and getting in all the traffic jams. And it's also you meet people. And quite often they see you, and that's a quiet monk on the underground train, and they come and ask you questions. I remember this one occasion, I forget exactly where I was going to and from, but I was just sitting in the underground train minding my own business. And then this lady came on, middle-aged lady, and she came and sat right next to me. And the conversation was, are you a Buddhist monk? And I said, yes. And the next question was, are you a real Buddhist monk? Because they were rare, you know, travelling on underground trains. And this, she wanted to know something about Buddhism. So, you know, she had a few stops to go, so she started talking to me about, you know, Buddhism and what it teaches and how long I've been a monk and why I like being a monastic. And when it came about some of the things about Buddhism, one thing she asked me was, you know, about sort of reincarnation, rebirth. You know, do you really believe in that? And do you have to believe in that if you're a Buddhist? I said, of course. And I said, oh, look, I'll tell you a story. There was, on one of these retreats here in Jhana Grove, there was this man came in the interviews, like you have here, and in his interviews he said he had a very weird experience when he was meditating. He was very peaceful, and then he had this, like, nimitta or vision that he said that he looked at himself and he was like a piece of spaghetti. He was Italian, But I thought that was really weird. And then he also said that previously, a day earlier, had another similar experience, and in his meditation, you know, he thought he was a piece of macaroni. He said, "What's going on? You know, these nimittas you have." And I said, I was a bit surprised at first. This actually happened. And it surprised at first, but then I actually got it. I said, "You're recollecting your past lives." Now, any of you have ever been on an underground train in London, no one ever has eye contact with you. No one ever laughs. They're in that train looking down, looking at their mobile phones, or in those days, looking at the newspapers. But as soon as I said that punchline, everybody in the carriage, they looked away from their mobile phones, up from their papers. They were all listening. Some of them actually laughed, but most of them groaned. But at least they're paying attention, and they know that sort of Buddhist practice and Buddhist monks can be fun. And that's important. You know, the joy of meditation, the joy of understanding the Dhamma, the ability to tell absolutely stupid jokes in public, and at least give someone to talk about when they get to the office afterwards. That's a beautiful thing you can add to this world. Why are people so shy? Worried what other people think of you? And I said, "Look, I'm a Buddhist monk, got a bald head and a brown robe. If I was worried what people thought of me, I would never get on an underground train dressed like this." And another time, you know, as always, when you get on an underground train as a Buddhist monk, bald head, brown robe, you feel a bit sort of strange. But there was one time, I'd just gone to see my brother in the north of London, and I was getting on an underground train to go into town to give another talk. And I was on the underground train early. I was sitting there, one of the first in the carriage. It was at one of the terminuses to the north of London. I was sitting there quietly, and I couldn't believe it. All these people started coming in. They were dressed as vampires. And a few other people came in, dressed with witches' hats. And I thought, what's going on here? And then, but for once, with all the people dressed in strange clothing, for once I felt normal. And of course, the reason they were all dressed like that was, it was Halloween's day, or Halloween's night. And they were always going into London for parties. And they were all dressed up as something weird. So for once I felt at home. And they asked me, "What are you dressed as?" I said, "This is my... I'm not into Halloween parties. This is my dress. I'm a Buddhist monk." Cool. But what that also does, you know, you can contact with other people. And it's also, it can inspire them. Just like, you know, when we explain to Ajahn Chah, you know, why are you doing Christmas for? Peace and goodwill to all beings. Well, he said, I can agree with that. So every time there was a 25th of December, he would always come to Wat Banan Achat, give us a talk, and he'd say to us, "Merry Buddhamas." We gave it a new name. In other words, we can make use of almost anything to inspire people, to make people happy, to give people a deeper meaning in life. And that inspiration is an important part of our Buddhist path. And if one starts one's meditation, but first of all starts to remember something inspiring one has done, something inspiring you have seen, which other people have done, some really good karma you've witnessed, or even better, things in your own life which you've done, which, if you're honest about it, incredible, it's wonderful. And those are the sorts of things which is very helpful to start your meditation with, something which inspires you. And there's so many things which I have witnessed in my life as a monk which are incredibly inspiring. You know, one of the greatest acts of, the second greatest act of kindness and generosity which I saw, you know, concerned this Laotian refugee. And the Laotian, she was very devoted to the temple. She was so happy there was a temple in Perth she could go to. And she could speak in Laotian, and the two monks there, Ajahn Jaka at the time and myself, could understand Lao, could speak to her in Lao. And so she was very happy there. But one terrible thing was that she had been from the refugee camps and on the Thai side of the border, she had been sent to Perth. While everybody else in our family had been sent to Washington State. I never exactly found out why. Washington State in the US, you know, because of WA. And we share that state acronym, with Washington State in the US. So all her family was sent over there and she ended up here. And she didn't know where she was going to, where she arrived, but she made the best of things here, very hard working, and found a nice partner to share a home with, very devoted. So she eventually started to live, you know, pretty okay. But the first year she was here, I remember her coming to our temple and she was crying her eyes out. She wanted to talk to me, what's up? And she just got a, in those days, telegram, like, you know, a very fast emergency email. And the telegram read that her mother was really sick. They moved to Oregon, very sick in Oregon. Can she come home as soon as possible? Her mother is dying. Now you can understand what it feels like when someone as close to you as like a mother is really sick overseas and you can't get to her. Oregon is a long way from Perth. And this lady was a refugee and she hadn't got any money at all. That's why she was standing in front of me, crying her eyes out. What can I do? What can I do? I need to go and see my mum. But it costs so much money to get a flight. I can't do it. And while I was, she was saying this to me, and I was thinking of what can I do to help, there was one of our other followers. She was a Thai girl. She was out of work. She was a nurse, but she had injured her back. And the hospital or medical service, the nurses' union, whatever, was not paying her compensation. And so she was fighting for that. She hadn't any money. But nevertheless, I remember just seeing her silently get something out of her bag. It was her checkbook. And she just wrote, she just signed it and gave this blank check to this Laotian lady. No amount written on it. She didn't know who it should be made out to. She just gave it to this girl and said, go see your mum. And I kind of knew both of these people. And the Laotian lady, the Thai lady, the nurse out of work, didn't have any money. She had a kid. She was trying her best to look after. It was very, very difficult for her. But nevertheless, seeing your mum is more important. So she gave over this check to this young girl. And I thought it was a very beautiful act of generosity. And when I remember that, as I'm talking to you about it, I remember that, I think, wow, it brings like joy in my heart how people can be so good and so kind. One of the other acts of generosity, which I was really very happy to see, was when I was cleaning up the hall in Awat Nanachat many years ago. In the afternoon, no one was around, and they had a big cupboard there where we kept the robes which were donated. And I just happened to be sweeping behind that when I heard somebody come into the hall. And they were just not like normally, just walking in slowly. No, they were just kind of scampering in. So behind the hall, so behind the cupboard, I peeked. I didn't want the person to see me. I thought it was a burglar coming in. But when that person came in. I recognized her straight away. She was one of the village girls. She had some sort of mental disability. That's what I used to call it, disability. But these days I just call it a mental difference. Because she could not speak. She could only grunt. But all the other girls of her age, any party, any celebration, they'd always take her with them. And, you know, she was part of the village. She wasn't, I don't think really, she really felt like discriminated against or ostracized. She was part of everything. But anyway, alone, she came furtively into the hall. She looked around to make sure no one was looking at her. She never saw me, thank goodness. And then she put something down on the shrine in front of the Buddha statue, bowed 3 times, and then ran out. And I was watching all of this. I said, what has she given to the Buddha statue? And I went to the statue, and I looked at someone had just put in like a folded lotus flower, like kind of origami. It wasn't beautiful. It was done by someone who was, you know, didn't have much skills and couldn't even speak. But it was her gift to the Buddha. And so many other things were so more beautiful on that shrine in terms of what other people say were beautiful. But when I saw that, I thought, wow, that took her so much effort to make that in her state of mind. And that's why she snuck in to put it on the shrine. If she'd given it to any monk, she was afraid that no monk would accept it. So she put it on there herself. And in the afternoon, when the monks came out for the tea time, I told them what I was doing there. And if any monk moves that gift or tries to throw it away because it's not beautiful enough, you can see another side of Ajahn Brahm. To me, I always remember that. It's a beautiful act of generosity and kindness. What she wanted to put up there, and she couldn't do it very much. But also the language was really important because, you know, she could grunt. I couldn't understand any of those grunts she made, but her friends could understand it perfectly. It was like another language she was communicating in because those friends had grown up with her and know exactly what each grunt meant. So anyway, it's one of the reasons why the kindness and generosity and things I've seen in my life like that are just so, so inspiring. It's not just, you know, amounts, what other people may say is inspiring. What I think is inspiring is just people's trust and beauty. And they do something kind and it's valued. So those are the sorts of things when I see that or I share them with you, it's something we can say is a very beautiful thing in a world. And inspires us. What disinspires us, you know, sometimes I'm trying to find out the opposite of inspiration. I think there's two words which are close to the opposite of inspiration, and that's desperation and expiration. The negative parts of spirations. But nevertheless, that when, if we remember something bad happened, that, you know, that all the noodles were taken from breakfast before you could get there. All the best fruit had already been gone and you never got some today. Or you missed your breakfast because you're having some nice meditation, or you slept in this morning. You miss your breakfast and, oh, you feel just so upset. You're going to have to wait for a while before you get something to eat. But you find that somebody in your cottage saved you something. They never needed to do that, but they do. And then what you get, what was saved by one of your friends in your cottage is almost exactly what you want. You think, wow, people in this place are so kind. You don't even know them. You've never met them before. But nevertheless, they look out for you. That sort of kindness there, that inspires me. And I hope it inspires each one of you as well. And when you feel that inspiration happening, it's a great place to start your meditation from. The beauty of this, of humanity, just the wonderful things they can do, and just how this world can work in such a beautiful, inspiring way. It's a pleasure to get up in the morning and see what's the latest beautiful thing which has happened in this world. I know this afternoon at 1 o'clock, many of you are going to my cave. You have to be careful in that cave. There used to be a bat in there. There used to be two bats. They've both been auctioned off. I'm now batless. Another bat will come in there soon. But anyhow, just why is that the case? It's because people told me, they've heard all my stories of how I like the smell of bat poo, and the caves I've been to in Thailand where there's so many bats, and they thought, well, you've got a cave there. What's a cave without a bat? So they've got this special species of bat. It's called the IKEA species of bat, a little toy one. But nevertheless, one of those was in that cave. And that cave, I never asked for it, that when I was away, that some people, one of the persons, he was one of our top supporters. He didn't have much money, but he'd always be there to help, to work. And he was actually the one who found Dhammasara, and with Bianca. It was Bianca's partner, Ron Battersby. And he had some cancer, some blood cancer, and it seemed to get into remission. It later came back again and killed him. But he said, in the meantime, I've got some more months of life. I want to thank you all, monks, especially myself. And so he worked really hard starting to build this cave for me. He knew how much I like caves. And he's a really good builder. And later on, the monks took over to finish that cave. And I'm just so grateful to them. It's a beautiful thing they did. And the greatest gift, they always say, is a gift of Dhamma. But not like books of Dhamma, not information. We have almost an overload of information. But a place where you can practice Dhamma, where you can meditate. And this place over here is one of the things that inspires me. I say very proud of, because not just me who made this thing happen, but many other monks and nuns made this thing happen, Jhana Grove, many of you too. And I think just all the amazing goodness this has given in our world. All the people who've come here and got some nice meditation. For those of you who think, no, I can't meditate, I will argue with you. Everyone can meditate if you haven't done it yet. So many times, there's this story in the suttas, in the Terigata, of this nun. How many was it, 7 years or 13 years? She was meditating, getting nowhere. And then this teacher came along, just at the right time in the right place, taught her some nice ways of meditating, and this nun became fully enlightened. Fully enlightened, from almost nowhere. So if you come here and it's 8 days already and you haven't got fully enlightened yet, I think we have to get one of the nuns to give a talk. And if that doesn't work, I'm always hesitant to say this story, if that doesn't work, there was the story of another nun. I think she was the 13 years as a nun, or 7 years. Anyway, this was in the time of the Buddha, best teachers. She was really meditating full on. And then after, I think it was 7 years, after 7 years full on training as a bhikkhuni, she hadn't had one moment of peace. Always restless. And after all those years, on the anniversary of her first coming to become a bhikkhuni, she thought, if I haven't attained anything yet or got any peace yet, it's not going to happen. So she took another option. She went to the storeroom and got a long length of rope. She went into the forest She climbed one of the trees. She tied one end of the rope to a very strong branch. Another end of the rope around her neck. Why did she do that? Because she said, well, I can't get any peace in my meditation. And that's where she also said, I never want to go back to the three crooked things. And I think some of you have heard me say this before. What are the three crooked things for a woman in the time of the Buddha? It was like a euphemism, like what they would talk about. They said the first crooked thing was the broom, which they used to sweep the house, a symbol of housework. They didn't want to go back to housework anymore, just keep on sweeping. The third crooked thing was the ladle they used to make the curries with. So they didn't want to go back to cooking anymore. And the third crooked thing, please excuse me guys, was the husband. That's how bhikkhunis would talk. We don't want to go back to the three crooked things. So she tied the other end of the rope round her neck. We're just about to jump off. Now this is not recommended, okay? Please, Christina, if you're still here, please hide all the ropes. But just before she was about to jump off, when she was letting go, her mind let go. And she got into the first deep meditation she'd ever had. Deep meditation is sometimes strange. You do all the right things and nothing happens. But then you press this letting go button and it does occur. Or even a more well-known story, Ananda, the Buddha's attendant for 25 years. Imagine how much Dhamma he had heard. He heard everything, just with the Buddha, day and night. Not night, obviously, but no, all the time. And when the Buddha passed away, Venerable Ananda still wasn't enlightened. Can you imagine how hopeless he felt? I've been with the greatest teacher in the whole world for 25 years, and I'm still not enlightened. What hope is there for me? And then after the Buddha passed away, they had this big meeting of 500 enlightened beings. Actually, it wasn't 500 enlightened beings at first, it was 499, plus Ananda. And they let him come into this big meeting because they were trying to collect all the suttas and Vinaya together so they can actually keep a body of text. They would recite it to one another. And so that meant they had something they could have. These are the teachings of the Buddha. And Ananda had heard so much. That's why he was invited. And it was the following morning that the big meeting would happen. Now, to get some idea of what it must have felt like, imagine tomorrow morning on the last talk of this retreat, I made the announcement. Well done, everybody. Each one of you who've been on this retreat, every one of you are fully enlightened, except for you. How would that feel? Oh, you'd be so embarrassed. And that's what Ananda felt. Everyone else was enlightened at this big meeting, except for him. So the night before, he thought, "Why? Okay, I'm going to just meditate all night. I'm not going to go to sleep and be lazy. I'm going to meditate and meditate and meditate no matter what. I've got to break through because tomorrow morning I'd be embarrassed if I turn up there and I'm not enlightened." So he really worked hard. meditating, meditating, meditating. And when the sun came up in the morning, nothing happened at all. Still not enlightened. All that effort, all that understanding, all those years renunciating as a monk didn't work. So what did he do? He did what you would probably do. He decided, well, the meeting's not going to start for another couple of hours. I'll take a quick nap. And to this day I call this the Ananda method of enlightenment. He went to his room, he lay down, and as the tradition always says, when he lay down, before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened monk. He let go. Do you remember that story I said about the donkey chasing the durian? That's what was happening. He'd been chasing and chasing, chasing the durian, or the cow, or the mango in India. The people in the Punjab like durian?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, durian then. Indian. So he was chasing the durian, and then it's always in front of him, never comes to him. But then when you stop, durian goes further away, then comes towards you. That's what that nun did, about to jump off the tree. She let go. But fortunately, she didn't jump off, thank goodness. That's what Ananda did. He gave up trying to be enlightened, had a nap instead. Now you know why I asked you, if you feel tired, please go to your room and take a nap. If sitting meditation doesn't work, you can try the Ananda method. And people say, well, you've taken enough naps, it doesn't work. But the more naps you take, you're increasing the probability. So anyway, afterwards, right at the very end, as I say, the last thing you do, remember the retreat hasn't finished yet. You know, today, maybe this evening, or even tomorrow is the best time, when you really give up. I can't do it, it's hopeless. I've tried, I can't even meditate, and I'm really useless. I don't want to tell other people about this, but I'm useless. And that's the time it might happen. When you really let go. But anyway, what Ananda did next, you know, he was now fully enlightened, but how can you tell other people you're fully enlightened? You know, he knows all the Dhamma, he knows all the words. So all these other monks were waiting for him, and it came to the time the meeting was supposed to start. He hadn't arrived yet, so they closed the door and locked it, so they can have some peace while they were doing this meeting. And Ananda waited on purpose to be late. And he came in through the keyhole. This big light came through the keyhole, and Ananda appeared. It's called making an entrance. So, if any of you get enlightened, tomorrow morning, come in late for the chanting, and don't come through the door. Maybe I don't know, come through the ceiling or something. A big blaze of light. And I say, okay, fair enough, yeah. Well done. That was the Ananda method of enlightenment. But on the same topic, just sometimes you don't know how close each one of you are. And you can't know. You may be a long way away, you might be right close by. And this was one of those inspiring stories which I also remember. And that was of this young novice monk. And this young novice monk at Ajahn Chah's monastery. That one day that Ajahn Chah was giving a talk one evening. And of course, you know why these young men become monks in these forest monasteries is because their parent, usually don't have two parents, there's some difficulty in their family. Sometimes they've got too many children and they just physically can't look after them all. So they send one of them to a monastery to be looked after, or their parents die. Or there's some other reason why that they can't be looked after anywhere else, so they send them to a monastery. And they get looked after, and usually to about 16 or 17, and then they sort of go to school, and then they go to some college or university, and they live the life as a normal young man. But anyway, one of these young men, 12 or 13, I forget the age now, one evening Ajahn Chah was giving a talk. And as I mentioned earlier, that sometimes Ajahn Chah's talks go on for so long, and sometimes they're very inspiring, sometimes they're not inspiring at all. I always make this comment that when Ajahn Chah did say something inspiring, it was worth hours of listening to just ordinary stuff. Just one really inspiring word and it would change your life. It was worth it waiting. Anyway, this was one of the really uninspiring talks. And this little novice was listening to it. It was going on and on and on, and on, and on and on, and on, and on, and on. And this little novice started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? He was just a little novice. He had to be there. He had nowhere else to go in the world. And he said, all these other monks, they were adults, they were grown up, they could enjoy. He needed his sleep. So why can't I go and have a sleep? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that became like the mantra going through his head. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is Ajahn Brahm going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? And it kept on repeating itself for many, many minutes. And then we have what we call an insight. It's seeing things from a different angle, seeing things the other way around. This little novice then started contemplating, when am I going to stop? And the novice stopped. That's what he said many hours later when he came out of the first deep meditation that he'd ever experienced. It was past dawn, it was in the early morning. Late at night when the talk actually stopped, but he was still meditating. And all the noise, the ringing of the bell, the chanting, the bowing, the monks getting all their stuff together and leaving the hall, he hadn't heard any of that. He was quietly meditating away in deep meditation. And when the morning came and all the monks went out for alms food, he was still meditating. He never regretted missing his meal. It was the first time he had a deep meditation in his life. And he got it from stopping. He hadn't got anywhere close before. So that's one of the things I'm going to ask you. Stop. What does that do to your mind? You're not trying to get anywhere. You're not trying to get rid of anything. You're just stopping doing. And when you stop, if you had your eyes closed and it was really the right time, you usually go really deep in this meditation. You're doing letting go. You're giving up, renouncing, not moving, being still. And when you stop, you find even if any nimittas come up, they stop with you. They don't move, they don't go anywhere, they just go deeper and more brilliant. So stopping, Again, I don't know whether I said this in the first talk. Many times people would complain that they liked monks going on public transport because they actually could see some Buddhism. And some nuns, they see them. It's inspiring to see them. And if we always go in cars and no one can ever see us, it's quite disappointing. But even here in Perth, Buddhism is quite strong. But where are the temples? They always see the crosses, you know, for signifying Christianity. They see the mosques symbolizing just Islam. But what's the symbol of Buddhism? And I say that Buddhism is all over Perth. If you had eyes, you'd see all the signs of Buddhism being here. Every crossroad where you see a stop sign. That's the symbol of Buddhism. So if you come to a crossroads and a big stop sign, please put your hands up, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Simple things which people forget, how to stop and be still. Anyhow, one of the main things about this talk today is you don't know how close you are. And I've seen this happen just too many times with too many people. They feel they're hopeless, they're not getting anywhere. It's not working. And the little cause is, it's nothing to do with you. It's not you can or you can't. It's not what you do. It's just what happens. Sometimes all the causes come together at the right time, the right place, and you find it happens. You know, one of the first times you experience the, you know, what powers, you know, are inside a human being, it was a simple thing when I had the toothache. As a young monk in Thailand, you know, of course, you know, you don't know what you're eating or what's happening with your teeth, but I got a very bad toothache one night. No way I could sleep. The trouble is, in those days, you go to the medicine cabinet, and it's not just there's no cough mixture, but there was no aspirin or paracetamol or anything, because they're very poor monasteries. So I had this terrible toothache. There was nothing to take for it. Nothing would work. I was trying to meditate. I don't know if you've ever tried meditating on your breath when you've got this big pain in your mouth. And breathe it, oh, it hurts. I couldn't meditate. I tried doing walking meditation, something a bit more active. You know what I found I was doing? I wasn't doing walking meditation. I was doing running meditation. Because when it hurts so much, you can't do anything slowly. You're just running. And that wasn't working. So this is only my first year as a monk in Thailand. So I had all these superstitions about chanting and blessings and stuff. I didn't believe any of that. But when you're really desperate, you try anything. So I tried my chanting. And I didn't know much chanting, but I tried some. I had to stop that as well. The reason I stopped it, because I wasn't chanting. I was screaming. Yo! Oh! It really hurt. And I'd wake up all the other monks in the monastery. So I stopped that too. And he had this wonderful moment. What Ajahn Chah said once, he put it in a very beautiful way. You know, you can't go forward, you can't go backwards, and you can't stand still. You tried everything, and nothing works. And there's nothing more in your bag of tricks to try and solve the problem. And I know it's only a toothache, but that was unendurable for me. And so out of desperation, I just remembered two words, very short words. Let go. You've heard that word before, haven't you? Let go. Let go. Have you ever done it? And for once, because I was desperate, I had no choice, I did let go. And it was absolutely brilliant. It's just like the word stop. You've heard the word stop before. You've seen it on the corners of crossroads. have you really stopped? So I had no choice. It hurt too much. So I let go. And it was I say unbelievable, but it was true. I think you trust me. I'm not exaggerating here. 1 second, my whole mouth was just really in unendurable pain. And the next moment, I wasn't just peaceful. I was blissing out. Extreme pain had changed to extreme happiness. It happened so fast. You know, I didn't really contemplate why that happened so fast. I was just relieved it had happened. Thank you, it happened at all. And then I was just so energized, I did some more walking meditation, went back to my hut and thought I'd better lay down, get some rest. I think I did sleep for an hour, hour and a half, and then the bell for 3 o'clock for the chanting came up. And I woke up and I had a toothache, a very light toothache, easily enjoyable, nothing like it was the night before. But it was the power of what you can do, letting go. What that also meant for me, I knew in extreme pain, you knew what you could do and what could work. The real letting go. If ever you are in such pain, try that. But if you let go, you have to do it 100%. 99% doesn't work. That's why sometimes people say, let go, let go. It's not working, Ajahn Brahm, I can still feel the pain. You're not letting go, you're doing a deal, like business. Okay, I'll let go for a minute, as long as you let go of me and disappear. That's not letting go. It has to be real. I'm not going to fight you anymore. Whatever you do to me, I don't care. And that just brings me to the last story. And this is when sometimes people in interviews years ago, they would come up to me and they said, look, my meditation is really difficult. I said, well, what's happening? So I've got an attack of all the hindrances, every one of them, all at the same time. And instead of saying that's impossible, which it is when you think about it, how can you have wanting and ill will? How can you have sloth and torpor and restlessness at the same time? But that's, he said, that's what it feels like. Every hindrance there ever was, or some new ones that the Buddha never even knew about, they all came up to me at the same time. And so that's where I invented what I call the Nalagiri strategy. How to deal with really strong attacks of defilements, hindrances, poisons, whatever you call it. And the Nalagiri strategy is based on that incident in the time of the Buddha where somebody tried to kill the Buddha, assassinate the Buddha. And how they did it, that the Buddha was walking on arms round in one of these narrow streets in Rajagaha, and someone, they gave alcohol to an elephant, this big elephant, and made the elephant just out of its mind, drunk, and let him loose on the path where the Buddha was coming. And this was the Nalagiri elephant. Huge elephant, drunk, crazy, mad, smashing everything in its path, just whacking people out of the way, destroying everything. And the people who saw it coming, they decided they should warn the Buddha. And there was the Buddha walking very mindfully on arms round, with all the monks following him. And they said, get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming. And the Buddha never got out of the way, carried on walking slowly. Most of the monks, they ran away. And I know that sometimes people afterwards, they ask, I suppose they were supposed to be fearless monks. They were supposed to be arahants. What are they doing running away and climbing up the trees to get out of the way? I remember this is in Melinda Panha, Book of Stories. And they said, well, they had to do that. They knew they weren't afraid, but they had to sort of jump over the walls and hide in the houses because they wanted to let the Buddha be seen and what he was going to do next. Nice explanation, but I don't know if it really worked. So the only monk was with the Buddha facing this charging elephant, rampaging, destroying everything in its path, was Ananda, his faithful disciple. And as they saw this elephant charging towards them, so furious, so wild, so destructive, Ananda stood in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant kill me. Let him destroy me. I will save my teacher. So he put his arms out in front of the Buddha, sacrificing his own life and safety for his teacher. When I tell this part of the story, I always ask you, which one of you would do that for me? None of you. You'd be up the trees too. We don't need to, because the Buddha just gently pushed Ananda aside. It's very good, Ananda. You just go and hide somewhere. So the Buddha was facing Nalagiri, the symbol of peace and kindness, and the wild, crazy power of destruction embodied in this drunk elephant. And I don't know if you ever saw, as a kid, this movie called High Noon. These two gunslingers, I think the sheriff and this bad guy, and they're walking together on a gunfight, getting closer and closer and closer. You never knew what was going to happen next. That's what it reminded me of. High Noon, between the Buddha and this crazy elephant. What did the Buddha do? Now, I got total confidence that the Buddha had enormous psychic powers. The Buddha could have really easily grabbed Nalagiri by the trunk. And they're like, Kung Fu masters can do that. This is the Buddha. Grabbed him by the trunk, swung him 3 times around his head. And then the Buddha chuck him right over the Ganges River about 300 kilometers away. That'd be simple for a Buddha to do. Certainly had the ability to do that. But that's not being kind, is it? What I imagine the Buddha doing was, as the elephant was charging with big crazy eyes close towards the Buddha would have said something like, Nalagiri, the door of my heart is open to you. No matter what you ever do, you can crush me under your strong feet. You can pick me up in your trunk and smash me against one of the houses. You can gore me with your tusks. But Nalagiri, the door of my heart is always open to you. The unconditional loving kindness. That is more powerful than any kung fu move. And what happened next, according to all the stories of people who saw it and recorded it in the suttas, the Nalagiri just stopped. Stopped right in front of the Buddha, put his head down, and the Buddha stroked its trunk. There, there, Nalagiri. There, there. I call that the Nalagiri strategy. So if you have all these hindrances coming at you, greed, lust, ill will, anger, violence, suicide, what else you got? Psychosis, psychotic, whatever it is, all coming at the same time. And sloth and torpor as well, if you're really, I mean, you've got so much restlessness and doubt and everything. Say, dear hindrances, the door of my mind is always open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. I care for you, hindrances. And in a few minutes, all your hindrances will be bowed down in front of you, and you can actually stroke them. There, there, hindrances. There, there, hindrances. There, there, hindrances. I call that the Nalagiri strategy. Nothing can resist unconditional loving kindness. It has to be unconditional. If you do that, unconditional loving kindness, and Nilagiri is still staring at you with anger, and you think it's not working. It's not working because it's not unconditional. It's another deal you do. I will let go as long as you relax and be off. It has to be pure, unconditional loving kindness, and then you know it's power. So anyway, I always call that Nilagiri strategy. So if ever you have an attack of all the hindrances, now you know what to do. Easy. Okay? If it doesn't work, don't blame me. You can't blame me because you'll be dead. Okay, enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay.